Shattering Mist before we turn the page and consider Yah's testimony. I promised Nick that I would try to retrace my steps and find where the article appeared that said that the mosques were off limits. And my credibility for censor for that was the realization that I have had many insiders, even as guests on this program, as well as those that I've come to know over the years who work in the FBI, who work in the CIA, who work in military intelligence, as well as reporters who have presented the documents that are germane to those U.S. institutions, say that the U.S. government has redacted Islam from all of its terrorism training courses, documentations, and procedures. And so the fact that they would redact Islam, which was responsible for 99% of terrorist attacks in the world today, from their training and procedures manuals on terrorism certainly fits the kind of attitude that would lead to Moss being excluded from the NSA search. The story first appeared in the periodical called Investors.com. It is a division of Investors Business Daily. It then was picked up and carried by the Washington Times. And so you can Google both Washington Times and also the Investors Business Daily, and you will find the evidence behind those articles. So that, Nick, is the answer to your question. What I'd like to do now is turn the page, if I may. We would like to move on to beyond the creation account, beyond the plan that Yah emblazoned in his creation account, which is the pattern of 6 + 1 = 7, which is the pattern of everything that God communicates to us. If it's important to us, if it's important to God, the pattern is always 6 + 1. Patterns are extraordinarily important when it comes to understanding. When you recognize patterns, you make connections. When you bring things together, then you have understanding. And the single most repeated pattern, as we discovered over these past few weeks, is 6 + 1 = 7. Man, who was created on the sixth day, a carbon-based life form with the molecular weight of carbon being 6. In addition to God, who is one, equals God's desired result. It's the purpose the universe was conceived. It's the reason that he authored life. It is the reason that he offered his Torah instruction and guidance. It's the reason that the covenant exists. 6 + 1 = 7. The path we walk from our troubled world to God's home is 6 steps, ending in the 7th, which is his home. It's through the Moed Mikre, the invitations to meet with God. That's why the creation account is presented in 6 days, plus a day that we spend with God, the Shabbat. When you understand that pattern, you'll understand the history of humanity after time with God in the garden. It, too, is 6 days of toil, followed by a day where we will live as we once did in the garden with God. There are very few things, therefore, more important in this formula of understanding the path to God, understanding time, understanding our history, understanding our salvation, understanding the very mindset of God than this 6 + 1 pattern. And the 6 + 1 pattern begins in the Garden of Great Joy, the Garden of Eden. And it will conclude with 1,000 years back in that garden, with God living with us on this planet. And so we're going to spend a good number of shows devoted to what happened in Eden, why it existed, what were the elements that were at play there, what was the opportunity, what was the consequence, what can we learn by investigating what was told to us about the conditions in Eden. Because when we know what happened then, we will know what will happen in our immediate future. Because we're headed back to where we began. That is the story of man. It is the story of God. So if you have a heart, a mind, to actually want to know who Yahweh is, and that's God's one and only name, if you'd like to know him as he is, if you would like to know what he wants, if you would like to know what he's offering, if you'd like to know how to accept, how to participate in the promises that he is offering and be part of his covenant, spend eternity with him in a garden of great joy, then what we learn over these next few weeks as we consider everything that he had to tell us about this garden will be extraordinarily important to you and your family. So this is the story of man, the story of living with God. We will discover Adam's and Chawa's nature. Adam is the Hebrew word for man. It is related to Adamah, which speaks of the very molecular substance of the earth itself. Chawa's name is based on the Hebrew verb for life, giving life. She, of course, has been renamed, for those of you who are not familiar with God's terminology, Eve, which is the name of a pagan goddess. Imagine that. Every English Bible, knowingly, purposefully, deliberately, deceptively, changed the name of Adam's wife from Chawa, which means life giver, to Eve, the name of a pagan goddess. They all claim to be the inerrant word of God, and yet they have all lied right there, bold-faced, unapologetically. Why did they change the name to Eve? Because it was changed by those who were promoting Christianity, which is simply a blend of pagan religions, of sun god lore of old, putting new names, which was the common theme of all of the sun god pagan religions of old, new names on the sun gods and the son of the sun. And in those religions, Eve was Earth, Mother Earth, the mother of God. She was the queen of heaven. And so they named Chawa, life giver, after the pagan goddess that was the mother of God, the queen of heaven. Well, if we study their nature, we will come to understand how they came to exist. We're going to explore their relationship with Yahweh. We're going to detail their rebellion and its consequence. But more than all of these things, God's going to reveal the nature of choice and the role that free will plays in forming loving relationships. Which, my friends, I can tell you personally, but my opinion doesn't matter. God will tell you that the most important and valuable commodity in the universe is a loving family relationship. The reason it's the most valuable commodity in the universe, it's the reason the universe exists. Without that reason, we don't exist. Nothing exists other than God himself. Love is the one thing that cannot be compelled. Even an omnipotent deity can't compel love. By the way, God does not ever say that he is omniscient, all-knowing. He never says that he is omnipresent, always everywhere. He can't be all-knowing because if he were all-knowing, then two things would change. He would cease to be infinite because the only way for God to be infinite is he has to constantly grow. And the only way that God can expand and grow is through the benefits that relationships provide. That exchange that is always new and fresh and exciting that exists in loving family relationships. That's how God grows. That's what makes God infinite, is this family covenant. But God can't be all-knowing because if he was all-knowing, he couldn't have a family. He specifically says that our sins, our offenses, our flaws, he doesn't see, that he blots out, that he forgets deliberately. There are things that he does not know because he does not want to know, because it's in our interest that he not know. The purpose of the garment of light floods us with his light obliterating any darkness. And God cannot be all everywhere at one time, omnipresent, because if he were to be, then he would cease to be a unique individual. And he tells us that he is a unique individual. The moment he is everywhere, then he is the grass, he is the flower, he is the bird, he is the tree, he is the rock. He is the molten core of the earth, he is the light of the stars. He ceased to be unique when he is everywhere. Those are human corruptions of who he actually is. But even if he were as religions make him, all-knowing, all-present, all-powerful, even if he was those things, he could not compel love. Can't be forced, can't be bought, can't be stolen, can't be held for ransom, can't even be manufactured, but it can be earned. There's a reason that rape is not love. It's conquest, it's force. As mankind's history unfolds, it's going to be increasingly clear that God himself cannot compel, force, cajole, love. That it has to have a legitimate, credible, even if it is counterproductive alternative not to love. Even if the choice is between becoming immortal, becoming perfect, becoming an adopted child in God's family, being enriched and empowered with him, spending eternity with the most wonderful individual in the universe, versus ceasing to exist. Even if the choice is great joy and the thrill of being part of the covenant family while we're mortal on this planet versus living under the haze and deception and gloom of religion and politics, even if that is the case, still, the vast majority of people choose not God. And there's really nothing that God can do to change that equation without destroying the entire purpose that the universe exists. So we're going to talk about choice as it relates to the garden. We're going to talk about the adversary and why he was necessary and why he was allowed into the garden and what he did to make himself so popular. Welcome back to Shattering Myths as we consider the ultimate myth shatterer, Yahweh's testimony. One of the things that we find is that the bottom line with all of this as it relates to love is that it requires the capacity not to love. If the object of Yahweh's affection cannot reject him, then accepting him becomes meaningless. And as mankind's history unfolds, this will become increasingly clear. One of the great myths of religion is to present God as a Lord and to present his message as it is good to fear him. But no one loves a Lord. A Lord commands, a Lord owns, a Lord requires capitulation. People are forced to bow down before a Lord. They have to submit to the Lord's authority. The Lord controls their lives. The people that exist in the lands controlled by lords are owned by those lords. They don't ever engender love. They engender hate. There are lots of people, that masses will capitulate to. The more power an individual has, the more people will capitulate. The reason so few people actually stand up and do what the Lavabit founder did and say, I am not going to go along. No matter how threatening the government is, I am not going to cower in fear. The reason that so few do it is that the consequences are so extreme. And so most people capitulate to fear. The Quran says, he who fears will obey. It's true. Fear is the mechanism of obedience. There's a reason that Yahweh tells us in his testimony that the fear of him is a man-made tradition taught by rote. He doesn't want to be feared. He isn't a Lord. The role that he desires in relationship to us as father. Fathers do not lord over their children. Children do not bow down to their fathers. Children do not worship their fathers. Fathers actually make sacrifices on behalf of their children. Fathers get down on their knees to lift their children up. Fathers, good fathers, are loved by their children. Their children never fear them. To fear a father means that that father is corrupt, is mean, is evil. The only fathers that are feared are evil. So if God is to be feared in the role of father, then religion is casting him as evil. And they like to do that because they exist then to protect the people from him and his wrath. But, ladies and gentlemen, you can't love someone you fear. No one loves the Lord. No one loves anyone that they're terrified of. And no good father is ever feared. Well, it's all about choice. It's the reason that religion exists, to offer an alternative to Yahweh, his covenant relationship. They are mutually exclusive, religion and relationship with God. Religion is the sinister consequence of free will, the residue of men concealing, corrupting, counterfeiting Yahweh's word. The story of Adam and Chawa in the Gan Eden. Gan is the Hebrew word for protective enclosure, a place where life grows and flourishes. And Eden is the Hebrew word for great joy, pleasure, happiness, merriment, a really good time. So this protective enclosure where life grows, that is, features just a wonderful, happy time, communicates on many levels, not unlike the creation accounts. We're about to encounter an accurate historical presentation, one that starts with man's time clock ticking. This is a spiritual parable communicating the importance of the family-oriented model. And Eden is a referendum on the nature of choice and free will. This presentation of Eden serves as a treatise on the laughter and tears that are inherent in loving relationships. It's also prophetic. Like our future, is actually knowable. We can know what's going to happen to us just over a little more than 20 years from now by looking to the conditions that existed in Eden just shy of 6,000 years ago. Yes, you can know exactly what life is going to be like in 20 years by looking back at the history Yahweh provided 6,000 years ago. It's wonderful sometimes to know where we're going, especially when where we're going is as joyful as the Garden of Eden. We'll return to Shattering Myths in a moment. Yes, indeed, ladies and gentlemen, our future is made known by our past. You know, the Christians are wont to tell you that anyone who tells you when things are going to happen, particularly what they call their second coming, is satanically inspired, and that they are antichrist, and that no one knows the hour, not even the Father, only the Father, not even the Son knows the hour. And of course, what they don't recognize is that the Olivet Discourse that Yahushua was citing at the time, he was reciting Zechariah, and he was reciting it in Hebrew. And that it got a bit twisted in terms of word order in Greek. But even in the Greek, the answer is right before the faces of Christians. They just don't pay any attention to it, which is that the weakest form of knowing, which is actually acquainted with, Oida, was used to translate what Yahusha said, which he said just not aware. And it was in the present tense, which means that the 11 fellas that he was chatting with at the time, that they weren't aware. And so it's not a statement that no one would ever know. I mean, God didn't give us his Torah, prophets, and Psalms so that we would stay stupid. mean, think of, I'm going to create a book called Teaching, and I'm going to teach you what's important for you to know. And then I'm going to create books called Prophets, which I'm going to tell you what's going to happen in the future. But the purpose of my teaching and the purpose of me telling you what's going to happen in the future is for you to remain absolutely stupid. I mean, the whole mythos of the religious explanation that you're never going to be able to figure out what God is telling us is just so unbelievably moronic. I guess that's why they call it faith, right? Because if you were to think about it rationally, if you were to examine the evidence and be logical about it, you could never come to that conclusion. Oh, Yahweh told us his timeline, all based on 6 plus 1 equals 7. He told us when things would happen, and you can quite easily, so long as you're receptive, so long as you enjoy the patterns and making connections, it's really quite easy to come up with a clear understanding of his timeline and know when he's going to return. It won't be his second coming. It will be his seventh. But it is easy to know that it's going to occur on Yom Kippurim, because he told us it's going to occur on Yom Kippurim. He told us that the last 1,000 years would mirror the story in creation. He told us that when he described the purpose of the Shabbat and said that he himself observed the Shabbat. And so we know that 6,000 years from the time that Adam and Chawa were expelled from this garden, that we will return to it, and that God will live with us in our home, and that it's going to be preceded by the Day of Reconciliations, and then the Eden will be established for 1,000 years on Sukkah. And all we have to do is determine what is 6,000 years from the time that Adam and Chawa were booted out of the garden, and then identify the landmarks along the way to know for certain what this day will be. We know the day of the year. He told us he's going to return on Yom Kippurim. And 5 days later, he's going to begin the millennial Shabbat, which is a 1,000-year celebration of not only the Sabbath, but of the Mikra of Sukkah. So it's what's yours, would be the question, right? Well, we know that everything he's ever done that's important is on a Yobel. Yobel is a time that Yahweh specifically says it's based upon Shabua, and the Sabbath. It's 7 times 7 plus 1, which is 50 years, that every 50 years there will be a time when the slaves are freed. That's God's intent. We are slaves to religion. We're slaves to politics. We're slaves to economic conditions. We're slaves to military adventurism. He says that every 50 years, I want every slave freed because I am freeing you. The Torah is my emancipation declaration, a real one, not based on skin color, but based upon the content of your heart, based upon your attitude, your love, your choice to embrace the conditions of my covenant. It's my emancipation declaration, your declaration of freedom. Happens every 50 years. All slaves are to be freed. All debts are to be forgiven. What debts do we have that matter? Our debts to God. The debt that the Passover lamb takes, not only as the doorway to life so that we don't experience our mortality, but to unyeast our souls of sin, of that debt, on the Shabbat of Matzah, so that we can be perfected, our ransom paid, our debts paid off in full, so that we can become part of Yahweh's family. He gave us this plan. He told us exactly what was going to happen and when it was going to happen. And all we have to do is realize it's going to be on a Yobel year, because that's the symbolism of the Yobel. And all we have to do is look back in history and find out that he fulfilled Pesach, Matzah, Bukurim, and Shavuot, the first four, Moed Mikre, in the Yobel of 4,000 Yah, just as he told us he would in the Genesis account, which is why we pay so much attention to Bar Rishith and the fourth day. Because in the fourth millennia of human existence after we had been booted out of the garden in year 4000 Yom. 33 CE on our pagan calendars, he fulfilled Pesach, Matzah, Bukurim, and Shavuah. Well, if we were to take 40 Yobel from that time, and why do I say 40? Because throughout Yah's Torah, he talks to us about periods of time of 40. That 40 is the common denominator in a period of time of testing and opportunity. Yosha tested 40 days and 40 nights. It rained 40 days and 40 nights during the flood. The 40 years that the children of Yisrael wandered in the wilderness before, in that interim period between being freed from the slavery of Egypt to the time that they were prepared to enter God's home in the promised land. 40. Over and over again. And so what is 40 times 50 when you're dealing with years? And when you realize what we're dealing with here is millennia, it becomes extraordinarily easy to see the pattern. 40 times 50 years is 2,000 years. What's 2,000 years plus 33 CE? So if you want to go from year 4,000 Yah, which we know because of Yahusha's fulfillment of the first four Mikre, occurred in 33 CE, for year 4,000 Yah, year 6,000 Yah, is therefore 2033. It's not hard to figure this stuff out. That's the time, the year that he's going to return. The day is Yom Kippurim. The day that we will re-enter the Garden of Eden as God's children. With him living in our presence, us living in his presence, the whole earth returned to the Garden of Great Joy. Is on Sukkah in that year. 5 days later after his return. It's easy. You even know how he's returning. Not dialed down as a physical manifestation, but as light. He's returning as Yahweh. Because that really is his only name. I mean, we know his name is not Jesus. It most certainly isn't Christ. But when we get right down to it, Yahusha is far more of a descriptive title, a description, if you will, a mission statement from a business perspective of what Yah was doing by fulfilling those four Moed Mikre, those dates in 33 CE, year 4000 Yah, and why he will return 40 Yobel later in 2033 and complete the last two. Yom Kippurim, the Day of Reconciliations, and Sukkah, camping out with God for all eternity. So if you look at what God has provided us in terms of prophetic witness and instruction, it's extraordinarily easy to know where we are going. And there is great comfort when you know where you're going. Yet there are times when it's fun to go on an adventure and you have no idea where you're going to end up. But this adventure is life itself. This adventure is the continuation of our very existence. This adventure is to God. You don't want to go into this adventure blind or you'll end up going in the wrong direction. You want to go on this journey with your eyes open. You want to know where you're going. And where we're going is to the Day of Reconciliations followed by Sukkah, a celebration of the Shabbat. We're going to camp out with God in his home as he turns this planet into his home. As his children, celebrating the covenant for 1,000 years. That is where we're going. So our future is known by our past. Yahweh's 7, Moed Mikra, particularly his 7th Sukkah, is invocative of our return to the Gan Eden. To this place where life flourishes in great joy and happiness. To camping out with God in a realm of perfect joy. Where time will eventually cease to flow as we know it. Where time will no longer be a constraint. Where time will no longer limit us. Where we'll no longer be stuck in time. will no longer be constrained by all of the issues associated with a feeble and flawed mortal body, a physical body, where we will become ever more like Yahweh, like light, able to soar with him, take great adventures with him, live with him, hug him from time to time as he hugs us back in return. That is where we're going. Now, to appreciate all of these intertwined testimonies, it is incumbent upon us to scrape away centuries of religious muck, which has been smeared on top of the Bereshith Genesis account by Jewish theologians and Christian theologians, even to a large degree Muslim theologians. In doing so, we must ask ourselves why Eve, the name of a pagan Mother Earth goddess, was substituted for Chawa, a name which means source of life. In Babylon, the Mother Earth goddess Asherah, also known as the Queen of Heaven and Mother of God, became Eve when she wed the evening star, also known as Satan. Asherah, in this guise, became known as the serpent goddess. She is now the Mary, Madonna, and Child of Roman Catholicism. We'll be back in a moment. Yes, indeed. God provided us with insights that not only tell us why he created the universe, which was for the experience in the Garden of Eden. God even told us that he would have been satisfied if there was only one of us to be his child. If Adam alone served that need that God had, that desire that God had for a free will loving relationship, God would have been satisfied. That's something to think about when so many religious institutions and others say that God wants to save everyone and that, you know, we all go to heaven and except the axe murderers and that all children go to heaven and that, you know, heaven's going to be this grand old big place. Yeah, no, God would have been satisfied with one. And when Yosha says very few will find the door to life and most will, the vast preponderance of people will march along with the masses to their own death and destruction. And when Yahweh wrote in the second of the three statements on the first of the two tablets that thousands will avail themselves of his mercy by walking to him in love and by closely examining, carefully considering the terms of the covenant. When he shared those things with us, he's telling us the truth that it's heaven's not going to be a very crowded place. God's home is it's going to be sparsely populated, and that doesn't bother God at all. It's sure that he is hopeful and would be happy if the preponderance of us chose to walk to him in love and to pay attention to the conditions associated with his covenant, and we embraced them, and we looked at his Torah as the most brilliant document ever written, and that we loved its every word and insight because of what it teaches us, and came, he would love it if the preponderance of us came to know him as he really is and embraced him as he is. But he knows that the vast preponderance will not, and that the vast preponderance of people will be deceived by religious myths of one sort or another, the Christians by their mythical New Testament, Pauline doctrine, Muslims by everything Muhammad said. It was something that was obvious that was going to occur, and God was willing to create the universe no matter how few people chose to form a relationship with him as he did. So it is something to think about in this regard, but you need to look at the Garden of Eden to see what time with God will be like. Would you want to spend all eternity with God in the conditions that existed in the Garden of Eden? Would you view that as fun? Now, if you're religious, you wouldn't. You're not going to be singing praise songs to him. You're not going to be bowing down to him. You're not going to be giving him gifts. You're not going to be calling him by horrible names. You're not going to be deceived by all manner of religious and political jargon. You're not going to be able to fear him. You're not going to be able to worship him. You know, if you're religious or political, if you don't like his Torah teaching, you'd find heaven hellish. And you'd make life miserable for God by making it miserable for yourself. So you can look at Eden and find out, are you interested in spending time with the God who created it and who interacted with humankind in that place? So to appreciate all of these intertwined testimonies, we are going to have to scrape away all of the centuries of religious corruption. We are going to have to find out why man chose to corrupt these testimonies and to ignore so many of them, to even ascribe them to myth, when Yahweh proved that he told us the truth. You know, along these lines, why does the church teach that Adam was the first human, rather than simply the first soul created in Yah's image with a nesama, a conscience, in addition to a nefesh consciousness? God goes out of his way to tell us that Adam was not the first animal, not the first mammal, nor the first Homo sapien. As he speaks of human communities living outside of the garden at the time of Adam's expulsion. Therefore, archaeologists and paleontologists have verified that the species that we consider human, Homo sapiens, has roamed the earth for approximately 100,000 years and was thriving well before the expulsion from the garden. Well, we're going to pick up the story of Adam and Chawa, of Yahweh, of the Garden of Great Joy, when Shattering Myths continues tomorrow. May Yah bless you all.